Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Adam Egoyan.
We have a few minutes for questions, and then we're going to have to clear out the theater. So if we can bring up the house lights.
Yes.
I have a quick question for you. In your movies, which music plays a large part in basically the overall effect of the movie, such as in Next of Kin to The Adjuster, certainly to Exotica, that's a different Indian theme of music. How much of your Armenian background, which I share the same Armenian background, is influenced in the movies with that layer of music? How much of that profoundly important step or process?
I think that the question is about music and how much of my Armenian background is sort of presented through the music, and what does it mean? And for me, the music that I heard as a child was really important because it was one of the few connections I actually had to my culture, because my family was... had moved to a small city on the west coast of Canada, and there wasn't a community to speak of. So the connections through music were really, really important. And I studied music, and my sister is a professional musician. So it's something that I feel very fluent in, and so to the point where I think, especially in Exotica, a lot of the music was even composed before the film was made. So it's important for me to be listening to the rhythms while I'm shooting or designing shots. But it's just, I think very often, you know, in the films, the emotions are so suppressed and are so held back. And it's the music that suggests that there is an emotional life, when the actors or when the screen images might suggest the opposite. And it's the music, especially in this film, I mean, in the first 20 minutes, I mean, it's only the music really that is able to create a sense of unity. So, but it's thought with that in mind. It's not something that's applied later on. And this film is using, I mean, you know, a very clear fugal sort of structure, you know, and use of counterpoint. And that's something that, you know, I think I feel very comfortable with. Yes?
I've noticed that in most of your films, unusually, it seems to me, there's no reference to the place, the city where things are happening. I know that Speaking Parts is in Toronto only because I recognize the little signs for the subway. Is that deliberate? Are you wanting to leave out a sense of place? Calendar's the only thing I can ever... The only film I remember that ever suggested that the film was taking place in Canada.
Well, yes, and I can't. It's really interesting as to why I've always felt uncomfortable with naming place. But for me, it somehow it would root the film too much in a particular reality, when I always viewed landscape and geography as representing the character's state of mind, and in that sense, tried to create a heightened sense of realism. So I think I've been cautious about being specific about the city, because I've thought that too much would then be placed on that city as being the reason why these people are in that particular state, as opposed to it being something more abstract. But Calendar was a breakthrough for me, because it was the first time I was able to actually identify you know, Armenia. And I don't even know if I identified Canada, but I think I did, yeah. So it was a breakthrough. But for me, I mean, you know, something like Adjuster, you know, where, you know, you have that house that's sort of in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I think that, you know, it could be anywhere in North America, and that's been something that I think has been part of the project of the films, is that sense of placelessness. Yes.
Do you think you need a certain life experience to create a work of depth?
Well, That's a trick question. I think that it's the other way around. You know, do you need a certain? I think creating works somehow contributes to a life experience somehow, and I'm not quite sure. I mean, how to respond to that in anything? But you know, I think my background obviously is obvious in the film, but there becomes a really, you know, at a certain point, you know, you can overestimate the influences that certain aspects of your upbringing have had, but ultimately, it's the only thing you're going to draw from, you know. So, you obviously have a story you just are dying to tell. But, I mean, I think that in this case, I mean, let's say speaking parts. I mean, I worked in a hotel for 5 years in a laundry room, not unlike that one. As a matter of fact, it was very interesting when we were actually building this set. I mean, it wasn't meant to be a set. It was meant to be, you know, a location with the budget we had for this film, but you know, the hotels in Toronto had a very peculiar sort of bylaw, which didn't allow a laundry chute to connect floors because it was a fire hazard. But where I worked, that was such an important part of that job, was, you know, having to be stuck in the basement of this place and sorting through other people's like dirty laundry, and then going up in this cart and collecting, you know, the laundry from these floors, putting it down a chute, and then going descending again and going through it. And so that was a very vivid experience for me. And let's say the whole other professional world explored here, the film world. Well, when I was doing my sort of TV work with the Hitchcock films, I mean, or let's say the absolute nadir of my professional life, which is not in this retrospective, I did the pilot of the Friday the 13th TV series. And you know, in that case, I mean, none of the producers were ever actually in Toronto. And we had to sort of, you know, communicate by phone, and they'd be watching rushes, and you know, they'd be talking to me and giving notes over the phone, and that's how I got the idea of this movie, with the, you know, that idea of a production coming into town. So yes, there are explicit ways you use your experience, and ultimately it's the only thing you can draw from, I think. Yeah.
I noticed that there was a thank you to Jim Benders in the credits. I was wondering
Yeah, this was about the thank you to Wim Wenders. Well, this was the film I made right after he had done this incredible gesture at the Montreal Festival of New Cinema and Video, where he'd won this prize for Wings of Desire, and I had won an honorable mention for Family Viewing, and on stage he gave me his prize. So it was a really, really amazing gesture, and so, you know, and that, you know, had a lasting effect on me, certainly. I mean, it's still the thing that people sort of, you know, keep mentioning as though it happened yesterday, though in my mind it sort of did, but it was just a very magical experience. So, yeah, there was a reference and a thanks to him for that.
I was just going to say that the situation, it was interesting, the idea that a writer, even though he wrote the story and it happened to him or her, it turns out they go and they change, at the last minute, they change it totally around there. I know it happened to Hitchcock made the Spellbound. I mean, the original story is about 50% totally different. But, I mean, does it happen a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, panic is one of the, you know, the operating principles of any film production, right? Like, people suddenly have ideas that they have to change, or, you know, suddenly, you know, something is going to fix the situation, right? And I think a lot of it is people sort of manipulating and being able to assert their own power. And so it happens all the time. And actually, there's so many odd stories associated with this making of this particular film, including one person who's convinced that I based this film on a particular experience that they had. And it's very, very odd, you know, given what the film is about and given the ongoing effect that this person has had in my life, because now she thinks that every film I've made is based on something in her life and that I have a direct access to her subconscious somehow. And it's very bizarre. I had this past week, the RCMP, which is our national police, came into my studio and said, look, I mean, you know, there's a claim against Exotica now, and they were actually investigating it. And I thought, you know, given, you know, what this movie is about and notions of ownership and appropriation, I just thought it was very, very strange that that particular experience is lingering. And ultimately, the only thing that she's accusing me of is the scene where you see the brother in the hospital with tubes coming out of his, you know, body, that happened to her father. So it's quite funny. And you know, given what the movie is about, and it's also sort of sad, she actually, when Exotica was being presented at the Cannes Film Festival, she sent off a letter to Cannes to asking them to stop the screening of the film. And it's just, it's funny how these things sort of, you know, invade your life. But, sorry, I had to get that off my mind. It's sort of an ongoing thing. Yes, and your question.
Well, I was wondering, it seems like a common theme between this film and in Exotica. There seems to be a connection between eroticism and loss. And I was just wondering.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, our sexual life is one of the ways that we transcend our experience, and it's like, it's so vital. And when you're looking at characters who have been damaged or who are suffering from a sense of grief or mourning, that's going to affect their sexuality. It's either going to, you know, infuse it with a sense of despair, or it's going to twist it in some way. I mean, I don't believe that you can remove someone's sexual identity from the other aspects of their personality. And it's one of the most, you know, the clearest windows we have into where that person is situated. So, you know, it's not as though one starts from the other. The two go hand in hand. So, I don't know how this is affecting him. I mean, I'm sure that it's at some point, I mean, it's just bizarre. I mean, you know, we're at a point now where we can't sort of leave him with other people. And so he's like on stage and it's given, you know, talk about family viewing. Absolutely. I have no idea what you're privy to. I mean, this is years of therapy. Okay.
Okay. We'll stop right now then before we. But anyhow, thanks for coming. It's really thrilling for us to have Adam here at this moment in his career, because this was kind of anticipated as being a breakthrough film for him, and the anticipation has, or dream has become a reality. It broke the box office records at the Angelica last week, where it took in $57,000 in its first week, which, not to dwell on money here, but $25,000, it's considered good for an opening, so this is really opening terrifically, and it's opened wide this weekend in a lot of theaters around the country. So it's really exciting to see this happening for Adam, and we're really thrilled to have him here. Tomorrow he's going to Brussels, where he's getting the Best Film of the Year award. He won an award from the French Film Critics for the Best Foreign Film, so it's really an exciting moment. So he's here to introduce the short film in Exotica. Please welcome Adam McGoyan.
Thank you. The really exciting news is that we're sharing the $57,000 that it grossed at the Angelica after the screening. We're just going to it's suspended in the ceiling and it'll just float down. I'd like to introduce my partner in life in art, Arsene Khanjian, at the back. And the short film was a really interesting project. I was asked, six directors were asked to make a four-minute film, which was a contemplation on a work of art that really had left an impression on them. And I think the other directors are like Jonathan Demme and Christoph Zanussi and a fellow Canadian, Guy Madden. I'm not sure who the other one is. Raul Ruiz, I think. Anyway, but so I thought about this, and actually our son is called Arshil, and he's named after Arshil Gorky. And I thought that'd be, so I decided to do a film based on a portrait of the artist and his mother by Arshil Gorky. And I did it in the form of a letter to Arshil describing his name and why he has his name. So it's very, very personal. And we just really literally saw it on, got the print like at the end of last week. So you're the first people to see it. And probably the only people who'll see it on film, because it's intended for broadcast on BBC. So we'll be here after the screening. And please enjoy. Thanks.
Okay. Arshil might have to come up here. And I just want to introduce again Arsene Khanjian. Who I think has appeared in all of your features, starting with Next of Kin.
Yeah.
And they were legally married in 93. So.
Yeah.
Okay. What I want to start with, you know, in terms of Exotica, in some ways it's such a different film than anything you've made, because it's relatively straightforward for you in terms of narrative style, and it's obviously got commercial appeal and has been doing very well. So I just want to ask you kind of basically what you feel about the success and reception to the film. I mean, what's your reaction to that?
Well, it's interesting because I'm a bit overwhelmed by the commercial response to it. I think that I wasn't aware, or I didn't consciously set out to make the film more accessible or to alter my style, but I think that there is a couple of factors at play. The film is set in a strip club. The film is called Exotica, and there are a number of images that creates in people's minds. Now, I wasn't aware of that, and I know it sounds naive perhaps, but I wasn't thinking of that as I made the film. But there's also a sense of spectacle in the movie, and the whole use of music and the creation of that club, I think, really grounds the film in a place or a central location that people want to go back to, as opposed to, let's say, you know, in the other films where the, you know, the central locations or the central sites were very disturbing, but in a way that was a bit more visceral. I mean, this one, the stories that connect these people in that place is certainly very disturbing. But I think the club itself is just so exciting to be in. And I think we were aware of that as we were shooting as well. It became, you know, as we started shooting the film, and I actually saw this club evolve. I mean, it was just very, very exciting to transform this warehouse into this place. And then you sort of populate it with people. And it's funny because you are creating that club, in effect.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the conception of this film, you had done some interesting, really varied projects right immediately before this.
Yeah.
I mean, you did En Passant, which was a short film.
Right.
Gross Misconduct, which we're showing next week, but people here haven't seen because it was a made-for-TV, a CBC kind of experimental bio film.
Yeah.
And then Calendar, which is completely uncategorizable,
yeah.
I mean, a kind of personal film with narrative elements.
Yeah.
And so, could you kind of talk about how Exotica evolved?
Well, it was a really interesting time, I guess, after The Adjuster, because in a way, you know, The Adjuster was positioned to be the breakthrough film, right? I mean, when that was taken by Orion Classics, I mean, it was supposed to have like a really, you know, like the type of release that Exotica is enjoying now. But what happened is that Orion went into bankruptcy, and it was an awful period in my life. And I must sort of preface this by saying, because there was an article that appeared in New York Magazine, which actually chronicled this very funny sort of period when I came to New York to do press for that. And I was in the Orion offices, and in the background, as I was talking to journalists, there was a glass wall, and I could see boxes being moved out. And it was just like so demoralizing. And anyway, this piece was printed in New York Magazine, and some of the people who were involved with Orion Classics at the time took offense because they thought I was criticizing them, and I wasn't, because they were really, you know, they made the decision to buy the film and they were very excited about it, but they just, you know, obviously were caught in this terrible, terrible situation. And so it really came out in a very haphazard way. And I thought that was like my big shot. You know, I thought that was going to be it. You know, if I didn't cross over with that movie, I never would. And so the period right after the release of The Adjuster was just an interesting one for me because I didn't quite know what I was going to do next. And we took The Adjuster to the Moscow Film Festival, and it won this prize for, you know, a special jury prize. And attached to this award was 1 million rubles to make a film in the Soviet Union. And at the time, that was a really considerable amount of money because the average feature film in the Soviet Union was 800,000 rubles. And I got very excited because I thought, well, here's a chance to make a film in Armenia, and which was then part of the Soviet Union. And over the course of the next year, not only did the ruble devalue to the point where it ended up being worth, well, I think now it's worth like $300, 1 million rubles, but also the Soviet Union split up. So Soviet Armenia became an independent country, and the prize didn't, you know, it wasn't there anymore. And I thought, oh, God, great. You know, I mean, that was another sort of opportunity blown. But then this German TV station said, okay, if you can make this for like $80,000, you know, you have total freedom. And I thought, well, this is it. So I just dove into that project. And at the same time, I was doing this television project, which was proposed to me, which is one of the greatest Canadian Gothic stories about this boy. You'll see it next week, and I'm really curious. I wish I could be here, and I can't. But
can I just erase this?
Sure. It's the story that all Canadians know about this boy called Brian Spencer, who was from a small town in northern Canada, and whose father was possessed that this kid should become a hockey player, and trained this kid and transformed him into this NHL star. He was invited into the NHL, and the night he was playing his first game that was being broadcast nationally on the CBC, the father went out and bought a new antenna so that he could watch his son, you know, in this remote village in northern Canada. And what happened, though, was that night the CBC, the National Broadcasting Corporation, decided not to broadcast the game in that part of the country. And the father flipped out and got a rifle, got into his car, and drove 100 miles to the local sort of television station and held it hostage, demanding that they broadcast his son's game. And at the very moment, and this is just the most amazing, you know, bit of synchronicity, at the very moment that Brian Spencer, his son, was being interviewed between periods on air in the eastern part of the country, at that precise moment, the National Guard, the RCMP, ambushed the television station and shot the father dead. So it's just like this, you know, this epic tale, you know, it's like, whoa. And the material was irresistible. Mm-hmm. And so it just came up at that time. So, you know, you really have very little control over, you know, when projects are proposed to you. I mean, you think you do, and you think that these are things that you can sort of steer. But I think after The Adjuster, it was just this period where I was just floating a bit. And then Exotica, you know, came up as a response in some ways to those two different types of projects. I mean, everything is a response to what you've done before, and I find that's, you know, if I can sort of keep that approach to my filmmaking, I'd be really happy. Mm-hmm. It gets more and more difficult, though, because you are sort of geared or sort of invited to go in a certain path,
yeah.
And you have to really make certain choices and decide, you know, what it is you're actually getting into. I think the rules are always pretty obvious, and it's always shocking to me how filmmakers sort of stumble into a project and later on sort of, you know, start saying, I lost control over it, or, you know, I wasn't able to make the film I wanted. And if you look at, you know, the origin of those projects, I mean, I think the ground rules are always pretty clear. And very often you just rush into something without thinking, you know, what is the, you know, the possible worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just tried to always, I mean, with the exception of the American television shows that I did, I've always had a lot of control over the films.
It also seems like you pick projects where you kind of get into them, but then are exploring along the way. I mean,
yeah.
You talked about rejecting scripts because you can kind of see everything and there's nothing left to explore cinematically.
Well, that's the other really difficult decision. Sometimes you're given a script or project which you would love to watch. You would love to spend 2 hours of your life watching, but then you have to make, you know, the decision as to whether or not you want to spend 2 years of your life making it. And you also have to think, well, is this something that I'd be interested in for about 4 months or 3 months? And, you know, what happens then? I mean, my worst nightmare is to throw myself into something and then right before the shooting begins, realize that you've exhausted all your own sort of ideas about it, or
yeah.
You've just become bored with it. Because that shows up on screen. I mean, it's always, you know, so obvious when that happens. And to me, the most exciting projects are the ones where there's an alchemy involved and you don't quite know what the final, you know, product is going to be, but you just try and combine those elements and just see how it works out.
Yeah.
And in an industry which is so governed by panic, you know, where people are so, you know, unsure of whether or not something's going to work, and especially now with, you know, test screenings and market screenings, you know, people are so prone to kind of want to change things and to fiddle with things, and you just have to really guard yourself from that.
Now, is this different in Canada, where there's more of a tradition of non-narrative films, of documentaries,
yeah.
Experimental films? And government support feature filmmaking?
I think that one of the advantages of working in Canada is that you are working in a situation where if, you know, when a film is finished, you can certainly, if it gets invited to be presented within the American sort of system, it's there as a final sort of, you know, product which is ready to be exploited. But the actual making of the film is at a remove from the industry. You just don't have the same types of pressures. And it's interesting because, I mean, if I remember I was talking with David Cronenberg about this, and, you know, even when you do studio films in Canada, you do have that sort of that slight buffer, you know. And it's a psychological effect more than anything else because, of course, I mean, the notion, I mean, Canada, you know, in terms of distance is not... You know, it's there's no physical distance. It's not like Australia. If you talk to an Australian filmmaker, I mean, they will actually talk about the psychological effect of having the physical distance away mm-hmm. from the industry. But that's not the case in Canada. It's just you don't have the type of you're not under the magnifying glass as mm-hmm. much. But you know that's in the process of changing, I think.
One of the things that you'd moved away from, because your films are your six feature films are they're all very different mm-hmm. from each other. In a lot of ways, and your earlier films, Family Viewing especially, was kind of noted for its interest in technologies and a difference, a lot of surveillance cameras and a use of video footage versus film footage. And it seemed, you know, with your earlier films, you were really known as a director interested in that aspect. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you've moved away from that. I mean, we don't, you know, see those kind of issues explored so much in right. Exotica. And what's interesting to me is that that's happening at a time when kind of the media, we're so infiltrated by media now. I mean, the kind of media frenzy and the importance of talk shows, you know, yeah. in our culture has grown so much. I mean, that's really exploded since you made Speaking Parts. I mean,
yeah, you know, it's funny watching the last reels of Speaking Parts now, you know, in terms of, you know, this whole, yeah. you know, like what's happening with television talk shows and the sort of the urgency of these shows, yeah. you know, the fact that, you know, those very mundane sort of events are sort of somehow conflated into these monumental sort of, yeah. you know, occurrences. Yeah, I think what happened is just that I felt, and it's always an interesting sort of, when you become very identified with a certain style and a certain technique mm-hmm. That you feel very close to, you also run the risk of self-parody. And it seems, especially in film, I mean, I think that a visual artist is able to go a lot further and to sort of identify a certain style to work within that. But a filmmaker always has to be aware of that point at which an audience is becoming too comfortable with a certain technique and they're not really being positioned psychologically in the way that you might intend them to be. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of my films, you know, almost invite a sense of displacement on the part of the viewer. But if mm-hmm. the texture of the video becomes too comforting, mm-hmm. Because they know how it's been used and they know what it means in the terms of the work, then it defeats its purpose. So I think mm-hmm. that I was really aware of in Exotica, you know, the themes and the ideas are very similar, but I'm trying to use a different way of showing how people slip into a world of image, you know, and right. and that those images don't have to necessarily be technologically oriented. They can also be more sort of theatrical, in a sense. Yeah. I mean, you know, so instead of a video screen, you have a schoolgirl's uniform, and you have to wonder, well, why is she wearing that uniform? What does that uniform signify? You know, how does it work as a filter or a buffer to, you know, the different levels of psychological pain that these people are trying to deal with? Yeah. So it's a different device, but the themes, I think, are similar.
Yeah, I think there's a theme that there's an obsession and a need to look, and there's something that's so emotionally important about looking.
Right.
That's more important than language. I mean, the language, there's a lot of kind of artificial setups in Exotica with mm-hmm. language. I mean, the kind of artificial situation of the father bringing home the babysitter.
Right.
And there was a story that this was kind of a... an idea that helped spark the film for you, just thinking about...
Oh, babysitters kind of are fascinating, right? I mean, it's like the first time that an adolescent woman is usually alone with an older man, and so, you know, it's one of these... And you know, when you think about, I mean, you know, the responsibility that you're placing on a relative stranger to look after your child, and all of the, you know, all of the things that it sort of... the notion of home, the notion of caring, the notion of a domestic sort of life, and someone guarding that while you're away from the hearth, you know, and you know, there's something almost mythological about it, but it all gets reduced at the end of the evening to a drive home, right? And what do people talk about during a drive home? I mean, you know, you can't afford to be silent because that becomes, you know, really uncomfortable. So, you know, you talk about, you know, what? You talk about school, you talk about, I mean, I'm always fascinated by situations where people have to talk, you know, and there's sort of something very, very, I mean, even this, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's just, it's interesting, you know, that, you know, to an extent, you know, the words that just sort of come out are an attempt to sort of, you know, deal with other tensions, you know, that are at play, and I find that there's a level of absurdity that I find really appealing in those types of situations because things come out that are unexpected, and I mean it's kind of funny. I mean, I guess now since it's sort of public knowledge, but I remember, like what is the origin of exotica? And I kept, I mean there is a very very specific origin in terms of, you know, my own private mythology, but I just didn't want to talk about it, really. And then it was very interesting, with the New York Times sort of profile piece in Arts and Leisure, Janet Maslin had called, and talked to Arsene, and Arsene sort of said, well, you know, it's based on this, you know, discovery of a former girlfriend of mine having had this incestuous relationship. And it was something I would never have said, you know, but it was just so funny that suddenly it's, you know, in the New York Times, and it's kind of like trumpeted out, you know. And so then, you know, and I got a call from, like, you know, Miramax, you know, well, why didn't you tell us that before? You know, it's great, you know, it's great, you know, it's great material. And I was like, the cat gets out of the bag in very strange ways. You
know, one thing that is also consistent with Exotica and your other films is this kind of counterpoint storytelling style. I mean, I called it a straightforward film, but there's always, I mean, even with Gross Misconduct, which is a TV movie, there's these parallel storylines. Right. We follow the Brian Spencer story and then the father kind of on a separate track. And you've said that this kind of fugal style that you've called it comes from a combination of your background in music and also channel hopping, just switching channels on TV.
So. I mean, I think that, you know, channel hopping has sort of rendered, you know, surrealism as a device rather redundant, you know, because we're constantly, you know, I mean, from a very early point, you know, as children, we're just, you know, aware of, like, totally incongruous sort of montage, you know, and things, you know, being put together in ways that make absolutely no sense, but which we have to absorb as some sort of a continuity. And so that, I think that affects, you know, certain ways that we perceive image. So I really do find that when I'm structuring films, I'm always aware of notions of attention span, you know, like when and when I need to kind of like switch off a scene, and I find this idea of you know, moving through different stories at the same time very natural. I mean, it's not as though I have a sort of a linear story and then I break it up. To me, it's just the way I think and the way I tend to structure, and it comes out very naturally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting how some people are able to absorb it and other people really resist it. Like, it's something that is very difficult because they need to, you know, a lot of people need to have some sort of reference. Like, when is a flashback, you know, signaled, and how is that signaled? As opposed to, you know, taking advantage of what film does best. I mean, you know, like, to me, one of the most inspiring books I read, I remember, was Tarkovsky's Sculpting in Time, which is what film is. I mean, film is just, you know, it's a recording of real time. And the ability to put a film together is, you know, how you rearrange those, you know, small fragments of time into this other entity, you know. And to me, it's very natural in that process to be using time in a very fluid way, mm-hmm. especially when you're dealing with issues of memory and where we situate ourselves in terms of our own relationship to experience. You know, in this film, I mean, you know, it's called Exotica, and there are all these sort of, you know, exotic locations, exotic flesh, you know, colors, and exotic sexualities, and exotic music. But ultimately, what's most exotic is the people's own relationship to their own memory, you know, and to their own family, and to the things which should be closest to them. But somehow they've become exoticized, if that's a word. You know, they've become somehow held at a remove, and they become something else. You have this father that's mourning the loss of his daughter, but the way he's chosen to do that, you know, only, you know, situates him further away, and in fact, you know, exaggerates his process of grieving to the point where it becomes, you know, ridiculous. Really, I mean, he's now tormenting himself over incestuous fantasies that he never even had, you know, but which have been triggered off by the source of, you know, well, therapy
seems,
that he's
there
chosen.
Seems to be a real ambivalence expressed in your films about the power of images that characters are always trying to grasp images and hold on to them and look at videotapes to deal with their memories, mm-hmm. but which in one sense is powerful, but you also question what, you know, what's really there, like what can they really grasp?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I think that, you know, before I had, you know, and we had our shield, I mean, you know, I was very, very suspicious about why do people videotape their families, for instance. I used to think, well, it was because, you know, it's to create some sort of an emotional barrier, but now it's so obvious, I mean, and that it's to do with the fear of the passage of time, right? I mean, you know, a child grows up so quickly and goes through all these different stages, and you just don't feel that you can absorb it all. So the need to document is just so comforting somehow. It's like this sense that you can you know, suspend time, and that it's there to review, and that, you know, it's true that our memory works in a very sort of fluid, organic way, that we don't quite remember what a child was like at 6 months or at 3 months, or and yet the idea that we have these personal archives that we can access becomes very comforting, even if we never look at them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that idea of people who have VCRs and, you know, they miss a show on television, but they sort of like set their you know, the VCR so it tapes it. And it's so interesting how rarely people actually go back and look at those shows, but still they have the sense that they have it, you know, that it's there, you know. So it's like this you know, technology is there to kind of, it's an extension of their own memory process. And that's only going to become more and more, you know, accentuated with, you know, with the new technologies that are being introduced every day. I mean, we just, and at what point do these technologies actually serve as metaphors for our own relationship to our consciousness? You know, the things that we don't understand about the way we feel somehow become either reduced or enhanced by these symbols, you know.
Do you think that video has really changed the way we experience things? I mean, one thing that you've said, one interview is that if you do an action that you think of as being documentable, that somehow makes the experience more real, and you were.
I was probably clumsily paraphrasing from an Italo Calvino short story called The Photographer, where this character sort of comes to the realization that, you know, that the photographs somehow make his life seem more, you know, full, and that at that point you come, you know, you have to make a decision. Either you live every moment of your life as though it were being photographed, or that you determine your actions as though they were worthy of, you know, photographic representation, and that one route leads to stupidity and the other to madness, but I don't remember which is which. So. Anyway, one of those things that you always think you should remember to have, you know, at your disposal at situations like this, but you never do. So.
I do have to ask you what kind of got you into film, because you talk about having a background in music and also theater,
yeah.
and film just seems like such a perfect medium for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, you know, it's funny because my fantasy was always to be a playwright. I mean, I started writing plays when I was really young, and I always really loved the idea of creating these worlds where people could behave exactly as I wanted them to, as opposed to another world around me, which never quite seemed to work that way. So I really wanted to be a playwright, but I never really found a voice as a playwright. I never really felt that my plays, you know, they always seemed to derive from other works that had influenced me. And then when I made my first film, I immediately sort of felt that the camera was this personality, was sort of a person who was watching this action, as opposed to just sort of being a device that would record action. It was actually something which defined someone's gaze, you know, and I thought that was just so elegant, you know, as a device. So this notion of, you know, in the earlier films, you know, that becomes quite literal, you know, where, you know, there are people who are missing, and like in Next of Kin, and though that device never really worked in that film, but the idea was, you know, there's this one moment where there's a therapy session, there's a video camera kind of watching this family that who has a missing child, and the therapist at one point says, okay, let's pretend that I'm your missing son. And at that point, you know, magically, the video camera sort of drifts off its tripod and begins to hover around the scene as though it was someone watching it. And that point just never really came across. It seemed more like a docudrama device. But I mean, that idea that somehow, you know, there are all these people that we miss, or these people that are, you know, that are absent in our lives that we need, and somehow this idea that they are watching us. Which is something that, you know, many of us sort of entertain and carry as a very sort of, it's a very calming sort of attitude. But yeah. The idea that we actually have an instrument that can show that and can participate in the drama that way is really exciting. So now in a film like Exotica, I mean, yes, there's the missing daughter, and all these people are grieving her absence. And even if it's not literal, I'm aware of, you know, that notion going into the design of the film, that there's this missing person who's watching these people deal with the consequences of her loss. Mm-hmm. And it's a, I find it very, it just roots me and it positions me as a filmmaker in a very solid way.
Okay, I want to give time for questions from the audience, so let's bring up the house lights and open up the floor. If anybody has questions. Okay.
I'm trying to do my first film, so I was just wondering if you could offer us, budding filmmakers, any good advice, which I'm sure you have.
Yeah. This advice for making first films. Well, I mean, you know, it's so great now to be able to have this small little camera that can record sound and image so inexpensively, and it's something that I mean, you know, 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, I mean, it requires so much capital and manpower to be able to just record synchronous sound, and now it's very contained. So I really do believe, and I know that there's sort of a school that kind of is against any filmmaker saying this, but I'm of the feeling that if you shoot anything, even on 8mm video, I mean, if it's really good, it will find its way, and I'm always surprised, given the quality of transfers now, that more films aren't being shot in 8mm. There's still this sort of, people still feel they have to sort of get together, the type of budget that you need to shoot in 16. And 16 is such an antiquated form now. I was aware of that when I was, making Calendar. Not so much in terms of film, but, let's say sound. I mean, it's ridiculous to try and work with 16 mag, which is what I was, trying to go back to after 10 years. The technology is just, disappearing. So I think that, the important thing is just to make images and not to wait until, not to wait not to work, let's say, if you want to direct films, I mean, you don't want to be on a set of a big film. It's just confusing, and it has absolutely nothing to do with how you're going to make your first film. And I've been in situations where there have been apprentice sort of directors who have, been on one of the bigger shoots, let's say, like Exotica. And it's just, it's daunting to them because it actually takes them further away from what they have to do. So I don't agree with that idea of, hanging around a film set. I think it's just a matter of defining your own way of making images. Like I was on the jury at Sundance, and one of the most exciting films I saw was this film called Rhythm Thief, which this guy had shot for like $10,000. And it was just so obvious that he just shot it on his own, or maybe with two other people. And it had this energy and spirit, which, you could never even begin to hope to get if you have a larger crew. So this idea of taking advantage of the mobility and the freedom of a like non-existent budget is tremendously appealing to me.
How hard was it to get?
He shot that on 16,
yeah.
But I think that could have been shot easily on 8mm and transferred, and it would have, and he manipulated the 16 as well. He used an optical printer, and it's a really exciting film. I mean, I think. Anyway, that's just my own.
How hard was it to get Next of Kin made, which was, you went from making shorts to 16, and it seems like one thing you did in that was do a lot of long takes. I mean, there's some very long shots.
Yeah.
In film, so how?
Well, I think that was the key, where it was just these very, very long sort of master shots. Because the moment you start getting into coverage, you just start going through film stock, and it's very scary, And so I was sort of aware of that, and I just wanted to kind of, plan the film away. And that was about the time that, Stranger than Paradise came up, mm-hmm. and the use of long takes there was really inspiring as well. Though I hadn't seen that film, I guess, at the time, but it just seemed so logical to make the film that way. So and that film was difficult to get the funding together because it was really just pieced together on like Arts Council grants and money that friends and I had saved and stuff like that, and mm-hmm. deferred salaries and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But again that could have been a movie that now I would have not hesitated in shooting an 8mm video.
Okay, back here.
How do you find acting in your own films, and how do you decide whether or not to do it? You had a big part in Calendar, you weren't in this at all, you had a small part.
Well, I really didn't want to be in Calendar. I mean, I don't identify myself as an actor, and it was, technically I had no choice, because we shot this stuff in Armenia, and I was behind the camera. And the idea was to come back to Canada and to have another actor dub over my voice in the Armenian scenes. And then have that person play, you know, the date scenes. But what happened is that there's so much overlapping dialogue in the stuff we did in Armenia that I had, we couldn't clean it up. We couldn't separate the track. So I had to be in it. And it was really, really difficult because at first I just took it, I didn't take it seriously until, you know, I was, you know, an actor I had worked with, you know, who happened to be there, fortunately, said, look, you know, you have to take this more seriously. You have to chart, you have to do all the things that you would do with us. You know, you have to take on the responsibility. And I, at that point, realized that I just don't identify myself. I have too much respect for what an actor does to just sort of be able to say, oh, I can do that. Because I think it works in the movie, but it was, someone was coaching me and was directing me. And I don't think it's a real craft, and I have just a lot of respect for what an actor does, and I don't think I'd rush into doing another film. Bill, if there are any offers now.
How has your working with actors changed over the years? Because it seems to be...
I think that, I mean, in the early films, I mean, I was really interested in stylizing the performance. I mean, having these people... I mean, it's interesting, because I really find that, you know, even though people might look at the early films as being very stilted and wooden in their acting, but I actually, that's exactly what I wanted. I mean, I wanted those, like, in family viewing, and I wanted those people to be reduced to that, you know, to speaking in this very stiff, uncomfortable way. And the problem is, when you're starting films, that people don't know how far to go in trusting the filmmaker, right? They don't quite know whether or not things are intended effects or whether or not it's just the result of the budget of the film or, you know, just the fact that, you know, you can't get a more naturalistic performance. But that film is exactly as I intended, you know, and I wouldn't have made it any differently. You know, right down to, you know, like the way the stuff in the condominium is shot, like a TV, like a really bad, low-budget soap opera with, you know, and that, all that was shot on video with live switching and then transferred to film. And I just find I like the tone of those films. So but Calendar was a breakthrough because it was the first film that was sort of improvised and it was a lot looser. And I think that a lot of that was brought to Exotica. You know, just letting people sort of go with their own stories. Because, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, I adore, like, the films of Mike Lee you know, the effects that he's able to get through an intense, intense period of rehearsal and living with the actors for, like, months, you know, and being able to shape material in a sort of collective way. I mean, that's so, so satisfying and so rich. But it's very difficult to do here with sort of the situation with unions and, you know, you just can't afford to do that to an extent. Unless, again, you know, it's your first film, and you can sort of avoid all of that stuff, and you can just actually take advantage of what, you know, freedoms you're given as a result of not having a budget.
Sorry, how did you get your first budgets to make?
Well, arts councils, like, you know, which are, you know, dying, of course, here as they are in Canada, but let's say, you know, the equivalent of like NEA grants and stuff like that. But you know, that system is really not what it was.
Okay. Sorry, wait, let's just give somebody else a
question, please.
Okay.
When you started making your first films and you were given money, was it hard for you to keep control of your vision? I mean, did you have producers?
No. I was the sole producer of those films, and I still, you know, like Exotica. I mean, you know, the way the film is made is structured around having control over the final product.
Okay, we're gonna go to the back.
Yeah,
up here.
Yeah, it seems like after watching the films today that you don't intend to have any laughs per se, yet we hear nervous laughter in the audience sometimes. I'm just wondering, do you put any thought into making the audience perhaps feel awkward at certain times or uncomfortable?
Oh yeah. No, I mean, it's like, to me, it's. I mean, there's something really mischievous about all of that, right? I mean, especially, I mean, you don't make a film like Exotica, you know, with that sort of title and that sort of, like, you know, the images that one associates with that, you know, they're just. But I think, on the other hand, I want you to enjoy that process of feeling self-conscious. I mean, I think it's part of the dialogue that the film proposes. I mean, what are you expecting to see?
Like, you know, and how far do you think this is going to go? Like, when, you know, when this stripper comes out dressed as a schoolgirl, I mean, you're supposed to squirm, you know, you're supposed to wonder, like, well, what is this filmmaker up to? You know, like, where is this going? Or when the guy's driving home, you know, this, you know, young woman and, you know, gives her money and, you know, and of course you're supposed to squirm and think, oh my God, it's like, you know, he can't touch her in the club, so he hires this young hooker. And at the end of the conversation, he says, say hi to your dad. And it's like, oh my God, like, you know, how sick is this, you know? And those are the images and those are the times in cinema that I find really exciting when you just don't know how far this is going to go. And it's like, or you can't believe what you think you're about to see. You know, I mean, I think that, and there is humor in that. I mean, those, you know, I think that there is a lot of humor in the films, but it's not where you'd expect it. I think that, you know, I expect my, when I make these films, I have the highest expectation of my viewers' curiosity, and otherwise I couldn't really make these movies this way. So I have to assume that A, people trust me, trust the fact that it's all going to come together in some way, that there is an emotional logic to it, but also are prepared to have a bit of play with it, because there, you know, for all the seriousness of the subject matter, there is a lot of, as I said, there's a lot of mischief in the filmmaking. Now I think we're prepared for that. I mean, you can't make films anymore and think that the process of filmmaking is somehow mysterious. It's not. I mean, I think that's what's really changed in our generation is that, you know, we all know what goes into the making of a film. I mean, here you have a whole museum dedicated to it. I mean, it's to deconstruct what it takes to make an image. And then, you know, if that's part of our vocabulary going into a movie, you know, let's take advantage of that, you know.
Okay, right here.
Was Calendar ever released in Armenia or distributed, or did you ever get a feel for what the people there were?
Yeah, it's difficult too because one of the odd decisions I made, and I kind of regret now, is that film was never blown up to 35, and it's difficult to show films in 16 in Soviet Armenia or Armenia now. So, from the times I have screened it to Armenians from Armenia, it doesn't make a lot of sense because it's very much about being outside of Armenia, and it's very much about the diaspora and experience of Armenia. And the whole dramatic sort of logic of it doesn't make a lot of sense if you are from there. It doesn't. And so on the one hand, I mean, I want to show it, but, oh, I'll give you a funny story. I mean, one of the co-producers of it from Armenia who did see it never really told me what they thought, and then they saw Exotica in Greece, and he was just so relieved because he loved Exotica. And he said, I really didn't get Calendar at all. And it's really interesting that, you know, I think Exotica would go over in Armenia much better than Calendar would. I mean, one of the things I learned about being there was that the amount of energy and time and emotional sort of projection that the diaspora sort of, you know, projects into Armenia is not reciprocated. I mean, they're just not as curious about what Armenians are doing outside as Armenians outside are curious about what goes on there. In a way, that makes sense, right? I mean, you know, they think that, well, if you really felt passionately about this country, you'd be there. I mean, so there are a lot of really strange sort of, you know, forces at play when you sort of begin to look at that dynamic.
How ambivalent are you about that, or how interested in I mean, the character you play in Calendar is like kind of very, you know, self-involved and diffident and like couldn't, you know.
Well, I guess it's my own worst nightmare of myself, right? So it's like, I'm not that, I was not that threatened about being there. But as a matter of fact, it's, in a way, it was the other way around. I mean, is Arsene here or is she? Outside with the baby, anyway. But I mean, you know, in a way, Arsene was a lot more scared about being there because she was raised within the Armenian community, and she had all these sort of images, you know, of like Armenia being this like complete utopia, and she was so frightened of having those images crushed that for her it was quite painful to be there. And I just didn't have any of that baggage going into the country, so I think in some ways I was really open while I was there, and not the character that I was playing at all. Mm-hmm.
Okay, down here.
Whatever the initial inspiration might have been for Exotica, whether it was babysitting or your friend's personal history, I wonder if you could speak for a moment about the writing and development of the film before you began production?
Well, the writing of Exotica was something that, there was a number of different scripts that are attempts at scripts I'd made before that were abandoned or just didn't seem to come together. And as Exotica formed, I was able to pull sort of different ideas that I'd explored. For instance, this idea of a relationship being formed during the search for a body. That was a very, very sort of compelling sort of backdrop for me. And it was something that I had attempted to make a whole feature film on before. But these people looking for a body, and over the course of the search, over the course of the day, they'd formed a relationship and almost forgotten what they were looking for. It had become very pastoral. And it was a very real time, almost like Before Sunrise, the Linkletter film, that sort of idea. But it didn't really, it was just sort of left at that. And then I'd written this whole script about this babysitter, about this suburban couple, suburban community that was going through this very embarrassing sort of collective crisis. Basically, there was like this amateur porn ring that was about to be sort of like discovered, and these people were just so terrified about what this was going to mean. But they couldn't really even talk to each other about it because they're also embarrassed. But they shared this babysitter that they drove home, and she became sort of the repository of all of their sort of like their neuroses. And it got to the point where even if they didn't need her services, they needed to drive her home because they had to talk, and she couldn't deal with that, and she began to farm out the services to other sort of people at the school she was at, and it became a sort of therapy club. And anyway, it was a sort of a broad, almost farcical structure, which I wasn't really comfortable with either. So things just sort of begin to evolve and cook, and it's always the most exciting part for me is when you're in the middle of a screenplay. And let's say the ending of the film, which I'm really proud of, didn't really come to me until the final draft. And it's interesting to me, it's just so mysterious, the process of writing, where you can sort of make allusions to things without having figured out what they mean. There was always that part where Christina said, I do things for him, he does things for me. And I never quite knew what that meant. And then, when I suddenly, the last scene was sort of given to me, and I do believe these scenes are given to you. I don't know where they come from, but suddenly you have them. It was so emotional for me, and then all I had to do was just go back to that statement and change it to the past tense. He's done things for me. And so much of the film just clicked into place. But I think that as a writer, you only really solve these problems when you're actually in the process of writing. I think too often you kind of think that you can just sort of go out and have a drink and it'll, but it always comes to me as I'm actually writing. And it's the thing I always forget is how you have to just throw, and it's, to me, the best part of making a film is writing and editing. Because you don't have the pressures of having to make a day or having to satisfy all these different sort of people around you, and you're just alone with the material, and it's so exquisite.
Okay, we actually just have time for one more question, and then we're going to join you outside. And I have to ask a traditional closing question in this sort of thing, which is what about your next film? If you tell us about
which was
announced already in the New York Times.
Yeah, well, I have optioned this book by Russell Banks, who's an extraordinary novelist, and it's I'm so proud to have the rights to this great book called The Sweet Hereafter. Now, as to whether, I don't know if it'll be my next film, but it's certainly what I'm writing now. I mean, I think I'm very, Russell himself told me, you have to get over your awe over the script, the book before you can write the script. And it's true. I'm just in such awe of what he's done with the form of the novel and how he's used that to tell the story. And I just have to, try and work with that, but it's great. It's a great story. So I don't know. I mean, I'm working on that now, and I've just never received as many scripts as last weekend. When I mean, it's incredible, right? I mean, it's quite funny. I mean, people who hadn't even seen the film, it just sort of, all of a sudden you become packageable, right? So it's an interesting time. I'm kind of exhausted because I just have been reading all of these scripts, and as I say, it's to me a huge issue, because would I ever have control over any of these projects? I don't know, and it's very important to me.
Okay, well, if anybody wants to have Adam sign books or you want to give him scripts,
yeah, no, please, no, no scripts.
thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.